Welcome to The Reader, your guide to Australian development in the region. This is a fortnightly podcast by the Development Intelligence Lab, hosted by our CEO, Bridie Rice.
Welcome back, Joe and James, to another episode of The Readout.
Hi, Bridie.
Hi, Jack. Thanks,
Bridie. There's certainly been plenty happening over the last fortnight, and today we're going to cover three things. First up, we'll be looking at recent development news. Think diplomatic appointments, Indonesian presidential visits, and of course, China and the Solomon Islands. Second, we'll be tackling a recent report out on the Sustainable Development Goals. Absolute spoiler alert on this one. Things are definitely looking bleak. And of course, back to our favourite and final topic for today, the soon-to-be-released Australian Development Policy. And this time we'll be talking about climate and specifically about climate finance. So let's dive in. Well, we have three news items for you today. First up, it is absolutely the season for diplomatic appointments. The past few weeks, we've seen a number of significant appointments made by the foreign minister. And I think there's four that are particularly relevant. We've got Ewan McDonald appointed on the 3rd of July as Australia's next High Commissioner to the Republic of Fiji and Australia's inaugural Special Envoy for the Pacific and Regional Affairs. We're going to come back to this one. But we've also had the appointment of Brenton Garlick as Australia's next High Commissioner to Tuvalu. And this is really significant as Brenton is a Kamilaroi man from northern New South Wales. So I was watching his LinkedIn feed, as I know you were, James and Joe, and it was absolutely going off in celebration of this First Nations accomplishment. We've also seen Rod Brazier formally appointed as Deputy Secretary in DFAT. Rod's current portfolio is international development. And Elizabeth Peake has been appointed as Head of Office of the Pacific, replacing Ewan. But back to Ewan McDonald and the Special Envoy role. Now, the Foreign Minister's press release on the 3rd of July said that Mr. McDonald will be Australia's first Special Envoy for the Pacific and Regional Affairs, and that this will enhance Australia's ability to respond to collective challenges and strengthen our engagement with regional organisations as a member of the Pacific Islands Forum. So, James, what is the significance of this appointment?
Well, the first thing is, as we know, Ewan is a long-term fan of the podcast, so it's great that we have access like that. More to the point, I think this would be one of the least uncertain decisions that this government has taken. Like, we knew this was going to happen probably a year ago, and there were jokes about it at the last estimates process. It's good because it represents continuity, and clearly Ewan has got extensive experience, and the envoy role itself is extremely good news. I think Australia has been a little bit behind the eight ball on that, so this is good. I think the only thing I'd like to add about this is what Ewan's job is going to be over the next few years. And I really think, I know we're going to talk about climate a little bit later, but I'd be watching this appointment really through the lens of the possible joint COP between the Pacific and Australia. And Ewan has got not very long to sort of build up that momentum and that credibility for what's going to be an absolutely crucial point. I mean, this really, Ewan is the sharp end of Australia's climate credibility in the region, and that's gonna be a tough gig. So good luck to you, Ewan.
On to now Australia and Indonesia. We also had the visit of Indonesia's President Joko Widodo earlier this month, and he was here for the annual leaders meeting between our two countries. Now, Widodo used the visit to outline his vision for an expanded economic partnership with Australia. He also made a really specific call for closer collaboration with Australia on the manufacturing of electric vehicle batteries. That was a really central focus. But what I also wanted to talk about was the announcements around easing some of the visa rules for Indonesians visiting Australia, a revamped program teaching Indonesian language and culture in Australian schools. And of course, Indonesia is already the 10th largest economy in terms of purchasing power parity, and it's making enormous gains in terms of poverty reduction, particularly over the last 5 to 10 years. So Widodo's ambition is for Indonesia to be the world's fifth largest economy by 2045. And Joe, I want to revisit something that you noted on our last podcast, which is that Australia's development relationship with Indonesia is really a model that Australia should consider emulating elsewhere. And I wanted to come back to you and ask, what role does Australian aid and development continue to play in a country that some would say is actually developing so successfully?
I think that it's increasingly actually an honour for us to be able to continue to work with a country like Indonesia that is going places so quickly. We get as much out of the relationship, if not more, than Indonesia gets. So it's such an exchange between respected partners that have decades of experience working together, have built this very deep and rich and extensive relationship. So I think that it's a real privilege for us to continue that relationship, and it's in both countries' interest to do so. And that is why it's, you know, the leading light, the beacon of where we want to be able to go with all of our development partnerships, because it does exemplify the kind of partnership and relationship that we want to be able to demonstrate wherever we're working.
James, interestingly enough, when you and I moonlighted on a podcast a number of years ago, we had a pretty serious conversation around just how important it is not to just to tackle poverty, but inequality as well. I get the sense you were thinking and talking about Indonesia. What have you got to say on this front?
First things first, I think President Widodo's right to focus on the economic relationship. I think it's the part of the bilateral relationship that's least well developed. I mean, our commercial interests and commercial exposure in Indonesia and vice versa, I think, are woefully underdeveloped. So I think that's the right place to start. I did want to mention, Bridie, that yesterday, very tragically, Australia lost one of its great Indonesianists, Professor Peter McCauley.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, I don't know if Peter was a professor, but he probably should have been. Peter used to be Deputy Director General of AusAid when I joined over 20 years ago. He was also Dean of the Asia Development Business Institute up in Tokyo, a highly credible individual. And the reason to comment on this is not just to mourn his passing, but also to note that we've got to find people who can take over from the likes of Peter in those people-to-people links. And I think it's nice the way Joe puts it about the honor that we have of being sort of a partner with Indonesia, but I think a lot more effort and perhaps a lot better outcomes are needed in building those people-to-people relationships so that Australia and Indonesia can be a more effective partnership.
Mm. And of course, Peter McCauley was absolutely key. I believe he wrote as one of his final pieces, a history of CSIS in Indonesia, one of the leading think tanks in Indonesia. And I think that's a great example of where the sorts of development projects and programs we have with Indonesia are very, very mature. We're talking about sophisticated policy and dialogue and analytical exchange there, not just what some would consider to be the bread and butter of aid and development. In the last couple of weeks, and the last week in particular, you would have to be living under a rock not to have noticed the media coming out of Solomon Islands. The Solomon Islands Prime Minister, Manasseh Sogavare, has just been in Beijing. And during this visit, the two countries signed an implementation plan on policing cooperation to run until 2025. In some respects, this is no surprise. We already had an announcement around Solomon Islands and China on policing coming out that I think sent a round of whiplash through most capital cities in Western donor countries last year. But this new announcement has not yet been made public. And that's something that has ticked off Australia as well as our allies. A spokesperson for the Foreign Minister, Penny Wong, said that Solomon Islands and China should provide transparency of their intentions to Australia. And of course, that they should publish the details of the plan. Now, all we know from the statement so far about the signing of the plan is that the Chinese government will provide support and help to Solomon Islands as needed in strengthening Solomon Islands' police law enforcement capacity. That is classic MOU language 101. I want to know what it means. So Joe and James, there's absolutely no doubt that a functional police force operating with integrity is a really important aspect of human security and of development writ large in every country. Australia, of course, has a long-standing relationship with Pacific Island police forces. What are the implications of this for Australia and Solomon Islands?
Well, I absolutely agree that law and justice is a critical area to be working with our partners on in the region. And Australia does have a lot of runs on the board, a lot of history in doing that. I think that what's happened here is of interest to us, even just from the perspective of being good development partners. We should be transparent and other donors should be transparent, because we should all be able to see what everyone is coming to the table with, and we should be able to work together and coordinate as much as we can. If our interest is in building strong police forces, supporting the rule of law in our partner countries, we should take a sector approach, which we know is what is good practice and what is needed to be effective. You can't just support one element of a justice sector and not all of the other elements. So we do take that kind of sector approach in many countries that Australia is providing law and justice assistance to, including Solomon Islands and Papua New Guinea and Vanuatu and others. And I think to do that well, we need all the arms of government working together. Ourselves, AFP and Attorney Generals and DFAT, of course, and DFAT-funded programs. And we need to be making decisions that are based on what the sector wants and needs, and really have the sector buy-in and ownership. This sector is too important to become, you know, the stomping ground for geopolitics, right? We can't be making decisions on what we do because of competitive instincts. There's too much at stake. People's lives and security are at stake. And so I think that we need to keep our eye on the ball in that regard.
What about you, James? Beyond transparency, what are we looking at here?
Well, I think a key point, two points. First of all, just to reiterate what Joe's talking about, the importance of policing and law and justice to people's lives. We know that, you know, through the sort of lens, the poverty lens is not just an income lens. It's about people's vulnerability and safety. And the law, the legal system and the law and justice system is an important part of that. So, you know, we play with it at our peril. I think the second point I'd make is about trust in institutions. As Joe says, the police force of any country is an incredibly important institution, and it needs to be trusted by its citizens. And so donors need to engage in those spaces with a focus on, you know, that old saying, do no harm. And if you undermine the institution of the police and you create mistrust in that institution, then they'll be hell to pay.
Well, there's certainly a heck of a lot to watch in terms of how this may or may not play out. Of course, China isn't the only one looking to cooperate and increase its policing cooperation in the Pacific. In the budget this year, we saw anything up to a $1.4 billion boost for both defence and policing. So I think that it's worth unpacking this issue further. And of course, with the new appointment of an Assistant Commissioner for International Engagement from AFP, I think there's a lot of us wanting to turn our minds to a lot more analysis and depth around how Australia does engage in the law and justice sector writ large in the Pacific, as you say, Joe, not perhaps just policing, but broader than that. Well, look, that wraps up our three news items for the week. We're now going to take a deep dive into a report recently released. So we're going to have a look at the Sustainable Development Goals, or what we're going to call the SDGs report. Of course, it is SDG review time in New York. So the latest report was released on the 10th of July. To coincide with the annual review process. That's something that is happening as we speak this week. So we're almost halfway through the 2030 SDG agenda. It's been 7 years since the SDGs were adopted in 2015, and we're around about 7 years away from the notional finish line being 2030. Now, it's looking like the accomplishment of these goals is a finishing line that we're not going to cross. The progress report was released last week, and it is frankly pretty sobering. Let me read you a highlight. What we're dealing with here is that progress on more than 50% of the targets of the SDGs has been identified as either weak or insufficient. And on 30% of the targets, it is stalled or is actually going into reverse. And we're talking about key sustainable development targets like poverty, hunger, climate change, and the broader environment. So what this report is saying is that unless we act now, the 2030 agenda could become an epitaph for a world that might have been. So in Australia, mention or use of the SDGs is cursory at best. I know we were all around when they were actually momentarily taken down from the DFAT windows at one point in time. And there's really been very little discussion of this latest report in the media. So I'm quite intrigued by this. Joe, maybe you up first. Why hasn't the framework resonated in Australia? And can you give us a sense of where SDGs figure in the imagination of Australia's development and foreign policy community?
I think that the SDGs are being used by organisations and donors do still refer to them. They are a useful reference point. People are still using them as metrics to some extent. But I agree that sort of the power of them in driving discussion and action and focus doesn't compare to the power of the MDGs. I do think that, you know, there was a trade-off between having a smaller set of much more focused, measurable, quantifiable targets versus a bigger set of more diverse, inclusive targets that are wide-ranging. Did probably lose some people, and people have a limited attention span and bandwidth and all of that. But it's also the second time around. So, you know, first time someone comes up with something, it did get global focus. Second time around, it sort of lost that edge. So for all of those reasons, it hasn't had the same power, but I think still serves as a useful reference point. It's not easy to negotiate these things. It's not easy to get agreement and actually have something that everybody agrees to use. So we can't throw the baby out, I don't think. But it is unfortunate that it just hasn't had that bang from a marketing sense. But of course, the more tragic thing is that we're way off track. That's the bigger story and the more important story.
James?
Yeah, well, I'm a big fan, as I was of the MDGs. I'm a big fan of the SDGs. We signed it. That's the bottom line. We signed it. If we want to step back, then that's fine. I'm not sure what the provisions are. I think the problem is that we haven't taken them as seriously as we should. Sure, there are problems with the vehicle. And while there's 17 goals, there are, is it 169 targets? I can't remember anyway. It's something like that.
Our producer, Julie Bolton here, who has spent a lifetime working on the SDGs, is nodding furiously, James. I think you got the target count right. 232, she's saying. 232 indicators, she's confirming for us there, James.
Well, there you go. So, and as I always say, whenever I'm commenting on, you know, aid memoirs or end of project reports, if you've got more than 10 recommendations, nobody's going to read them. So I don't know if they're going to read 169 targets and 200 and whatever it was. But anyway, so look, clearly there are challenges with it, but we signed up for it. More importantly, the world signed up to it. And that's the difference between this and the MDGs. It was a process which allowed the whole world to come together and debate and discuss. I think, you know, Joe's right. The outcomes are in and of themselves tragic, but they point to some issues that we understand. They point to the impact, the ongoing impact of COVID, the much more rapid exposure and consequences of climate change, the impact that we're having now from inflation. So the Ukraine war, the terrible news this week that we haven't mentioned yet of the refusal of the Russians to allow the grain exports. What did we hear this week? Over 100 million more people were facing hunger. So all of those aspects are dreadful, and the SDGs are a vehicle to draw attention to those issues. So frankly, I think this is a failure of international and domestic policy to make the SDGs more operational. Yes, there's a problem, and I think when we get to 2030 and look at what the next vehicle is going to be, I doubt we're going to have 169 targets, but that's the challenge of achieving global consensus. We need to do better on making the SDGs central, and I hope that that much delayed development policy that we're about to see is pretty bold about them.
Yeah, so do I. I had cause to revisit the framework recently in pursuit of trying to think differently about development, and I couldn't help but think it's actually one of the most sophisticated but underrated international frameworks going around. And I think you're right, James, people are simply overwhelmed by the challenges and the complexity of the SDGs. Where we go for the next 7 years, certainly that's what I would be watching, because if we're saying, hey, it's all too hard, and we're throwing up our hands in complacency or perhaps simply by being overwhelmed, then I don't think that bodes well for our new development policy or the region. Right. Well, turning now to our third and final segment for today, of course, we want to take a look at what will imminently be released, Australia's new development policy, and how it may or may not be factoring in climate finance. So the world, of course, experienced its three hottest days on record at the beginning of July. And at the same time, the world's financing for climate action is falling way short of what it needs to be and also what has been promised. The Foreign Minister and our Minister for International Development have made it very clear that climate change is going to be an absolutely key focus in Australia's new development policy. But what that looks like and what it will mean in practice is a lot less clear. So, Joe, how do you think the new development policy will be talking about climate, and where are you expecting the focus of it to be?
Well, I think the big question is, will it have a sufficiently significant focus on climate? I think there's a lot of expectation on that because there's a lot of priorities, right? And there's a lot of things that the development policy needs to cover. But there are also many people that think that climate change is it. It is the existential crisis facing us all. It needs to be the absolute lens over everything. It needs to be what development is going forward. So I'm not sure it's going to go as far as those people would like it to. But I certainly expect it to be very front and center of the new policy and very front and center of programming going forward.
I mean, Joe and James, you were around in the time of DFAT where gender mainstreaming happened. There was an extraordinary coalition of people that stood up inside and outside the department and said, you know what, gender equality is central to development. And what that is going to mean is that every single one of our programs, our approaches, our strategic settings, our resourcing is going to need to be accountable to gender. It's not some separate part of development. Is this what we're facing on climate policy?
I think absolutely, yes. There has been a lot of parallels drawn between climate change mainstreaming and gender mainstreaming approaches and the need to catch up and learn the lessons of how gender mainstreaming and twin track approach of both mainstreaming and standalone investments in gender have or haven't succeeded over the years. There's a lot of relevance for climate change there. So I think that is going to be part of the approach. And I do think that there is a lot of opportunity there for Australia because where we do have significant footprint and history and experience and involvement in multiple sectors and with lots of partners and actors, that creates a lot of entry points to then integrate climate change thinking and considerations in investments on that foundation, just like we were talking about before with Indonesia.
James, what's your take?
Well, I think I want to go back to the Pacific. I mean, poor countries in general, but the Pacific in particular, they're among the least, well, they are the least responsible for this situation that you rightly described, Bridie. And yet they're facing the most immediate consequences. And we can't get away from that. And I've already mentioned UN's sort of job description as he goes into his new envoy role. I think donors have not played a good game. Their focus on mitigation rather than adaptation, and even the adaptation vehicles like the Green Climate Fund have been terribly slow and clunky and hard to manage. There are, as we I think have said a few times on this program, there are communities in our region whose ability to withstand particularly sea level rise is now screwed. I mean, we are not building the seawalls we need to allow people to continue to exist in these places. It's a really tragic situation. The donors have got these ridiculous climate financing rules where it's almost impossible to work out how much money has been given and to what and from what base. Charles Kenny at the Center for Global Development has written extensively on this. We should be seeing the donors coming together and being more unequivocal and more transparent about the finance that Joe is rightly pointing out is critical for us to be able to address this issue. We have got vast, to some extent, untapped superannuation funds in Australia that could be part of this solution. Like Australia is holding some of the cards, not to mention its leading role in some of the renewable technologies and deployment of renewable technologies. So we do have a lot going with us, but the donor community has not got the mechanisms in place that are allowing the communities of the Pacific and elsewhere in the world that are facing the big challenges through no fault of their own. Let's hope that the new policy can be more explicit and eloquent and clear on this, because 45.2.5 is it in, today in Rome? This is going in directions that we will want, but it's going there. And these communities of the region are paying the price.
At the lab, we were lucky enough to host the former president of Kiribati, Ngāti Tong, here for a discussion recently. And it's hard not to be reminded of just how stark and frightened people like him and others across the Pacific are around the realities they're going to face. But at the same time, listening to you speak, it does strike me, Joe and James, that this is not just an issue for the development policy alone. In fact, the budget available to the development policy, even if we were to mobilize additional climate finance, is tiny compared to what is needed right now. Are you seeing any hope with the chance that Australia might host COP31 with the Pacific Islands? Is there a chance for those of us close to government to be applying pressure to show the kind of leadership and the kind of mobilisation of other elements of Australian statecraft to really tackle climate finance here?
I mean, I actually think here is where geostrategic competition is something that will play in our favour. If we're going to lead in COP31, if it is COP31, we've got to have a credible solution to this, because our ability to get away with, you know, delay and obfuscation is pretty much past. So either we deal with it at COP31, or some of the scenarios that we've been hearing about this week from other parts of the region are going to come into play, and it's going to be our own fault.
I think the big opportunity here also is for Australia to really come behind Pacific leadership on this. That is driven from an absolute place of lived experience, as James just said. They are living and breathing this. This is their reality. There is extraordinary leadership on this coming from the Pacific, driven by this need. And we have a huge opportunity to come behind that and support that. It aligns with our focus on partnership, with our focus on locally led development, but it is our chance to throw our weight behind our Pacific partners as much as we can.
Absolutely. And of course, it would be remiss of me not to let this segment of the episode pass without, of course, mentioning that whilst the Pacific Islands does take up a lot of the Australian headlines on climate change, this sort of challenge that is going to be experienced by those who are living in poverty and inequality throughout, for example, Southeast Asia, is also extraordinary in terms of the sheer numbers of the population, the disruption and the displacement that may be a result of climate change in that region as well. So Australian development policy, you've got a lot to live up to. We're expecting a lot on climate change, but I think we're also seeing that there's a lot more Australia can and should be doing in terms of the region and what it faces. Well, that brings us to the end of our episode today. Joe and James, thank you so much for joining us yet again. We are still, of course, waiting for the drop of Australia's new development policy. Joe and James, I cannot wait to have you back behind the mics to work out what it all means. But until then, thanks for another great episode. And for all of our listeners, feel free to catch up online on all of our previous episodes. And we'll be back once we have a new development policy. Joe and James, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bridie.
Thanks, Bridie.
The readout is recorded on the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri peoples, the traditional custodians of the Canberra area. We pay our respects to the elders, past, present, and emerging. This series, we've got two regular guests appearing on the program, Jo Cho and James Gilling. Jo is Head of Program Quality and Gender at DT Asia Pacific, and James is Regional Vice President East Asia and Pacific at ABT Associates. Both are appearing on the readout in their personal capacity. Subscribe to The Readout wherever you listen to your podcasts and sign up for the lab emails via our website. Content production by Julie Bolton. Music by Vijani Matale.